Welcome to Board Game Binge, the place where we bring you bite-sized, bingeable board game content from across the industry. I'm your host, James Staley, and in this episode, we're chatting with Drake Villarreal, lead developer for Final Frontier Games. Currently on Kickstarter is his newest title, The Sixth Realm. Drake, welcome to the binge. How you doing, sir?
Hey, I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it is amazing having you. And we're going to get into this game in a second because, man, does it ever look chunky, meaty, awesome. Meeples galore. I can't have enough words to describe. We're going to get into that in a second. But first and foremost, man, do you got a career so far? Like, gosh, I was going through the bio and I'm like, this guy's really been at this for quite some time. When did you start? When was the kind of the year you got into the gaming industry?
So my big break into the industry itself was with Merchant's Cove. I was brought on as a developer alongside Johnny Pack to work on Carl's game, Carl Van Ostrand, the original creator of Merchant's Cove. And Johnny and I had put in a lot of work on that, and Final Frontier and Carl, they all loved what we did on that. And we were offered, you know, more full designer credits. And since then it's, you know, sort of taken off, with designing more of the expansions and stuff for it as well. So that was my first break into the industry. But as far as like designing games and stuff, it goes back a lot further than that.
What was the first game you ever made?
Gosh, that's a good question, because there's so many different little ways to qualify it. Like, what's the first thing I ever tried to make or completed or played with other people? I want to say the first prototype that I ever, you know, really put a good amount of time into and built out was a little game called Mushroom Hollow that was, you can kind of think about it like a worse Takenoko. I didn't know Takenoko at the time, but okay. I like this idea of like, there's a hex grid and you're moving insects around to move the spores and grow mushrooms and do stuff like that. And, it was nice that, you know, being my first sort of the game that I actually tried to create, it kind of came full circle, because I ended up taking a lot of the things from that game and I used them in our recent Merchant's Cove expansion. So there's a mushroom farmer character that's sort of built onto the basis and the history of that idea.
Oh, that's cool. It's interesting when you see with game designers taking kind of sometimes having an idea and saying there's something here. Might not be right now. I'm going to kind of make sure I log it and park it, and maybe down the road I'll come back to it and we'll integrate it some way into another game, or maybe it'll kind of flourish into its own game and it's in its own right. Is that something that you kind of often do, and like, how do you approach, do you have like a logbook you use, or how do you kind of keep track of some of these ideas?
Usually when an idea strikes me enough, I'll make some kind of document for it, and that'll be there waiting whenever I need to tap back to it. But I heard something that really resonated with me, where a lot of the times designers get asked about theme or mechanisms, what comes first.
Yeah.
And for a lot of designers, it's neither. It's just the spark of an idea. And I had listened to a podcast a while ago, and there was a designer, I believe they were fairly prolific, who said that's where the games start, is with some spark of an idea, something that's like, aha, that's the game, whether it's theme or mechanisms or some idea of what you want the players to feel, or even a goofy little component, whatever it is, that can be the spark of the idea. So when you have those, it's, you know, pretty important to make some note of it somewhere, or at least to tell other people and see if they have, you know, some sort of, if it elicits some kind of reaction from them.
Yeah, I was talking to somebody recently about this as well, where I said, you know, with my, you know, brainstorming, I have in my computer just a list of folder names, and the folder might even be empty. It just might be a name on that folder, but that's that spark. And I think you've articulated it so well, because it is, it's not necessarily a theme. It's not necessarily, could even just be like an experience you're trying to have somebody have. And then you note that down, and then that is eventually going to blossom into something. Or it may not. Like, I've got files that have been on there for, gosh, probably close to like 8 years. But every now and then I go back and look at that list. I'm like, not yet. I'm not there on that one yet. But there's something there. I know there's something there. Maybe.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why one of my favorite things to work on was the most recent Merchant's Cove expansion that we did, Mastercraft, because we got to do four more characters for that,
Yeah.
and all of the characters were like, you know, myself and Carl sort of plumbing the depths of other stuff that we've tried and really wanted to do but hasn't found like an exact home for. So these are things that we had already vetted somewhat, that then it was easier to translate those rather than strictly coming up with things that are, you know, that are brand new. And
Yeah.
that's the nicest thing. It's like once you have that well of ideas, you can always go and drink from it, essentially. And you know, designers, they iterate on other designers' things like deck building. You know,
Sure.
we might owe it to Donald Vaccarino, but it's been used in so many ways, and not just in board games, but in video games. And I think we're all richer for it. So, you know, you should absolutely be able to steal your old ideas and re-implement them, and you know, the best ideas of those in the industry to create something novel and, you know, something people can get excited about.
Yeah, I'll get that sometimes too, like where I'll be playing a game and there'll be something in there that hadn't actually experienced it. I'm like, ooh, this is actually a solution. Like this little piece, not the whole game, but this little piece is actually a solution to something else I've been working on a while that I hadn't quite cracked. Let me go see if I can combine those and see if there's something there. Maybe there's not, but at least it sometimes gives you, and I think you're right. It's very iterative and it's like an evolution too, because each generation that comes after the generation before is better and it's adapting to kind of the new environment. And maybe it's combining different mechanics and bringing this together, that together. And that's going to create something new. And then the next generation is going to take that new thing and they're going to iterate it with something else. And from my perspective, I see it as really cool, right? It's like just kind of
Right.
imagine where we were 10 years ago, where we are now, and say, okay, what are board games going to look like 10 years, in the next 10 years? And I'm not
Right.
talking like digital, because most people, they think futuristic, everything's going to go digital. And again, I'm a big fan of things being very tactile, but I think just kind of these new ways of combining these ideas and creating new things, I can't even imagine what it's going to look like. But when we get there, I think it's going to be pretty exciting for all of us, for sure.
Yeah, and I think that there's of course going to be a little bit of pushback, but where I kind of see things going too is that we're going to, from the design and creation side of them, and we've already been trending this way, start to see games more as complete products and not solely like an idea. So it's
Yeah.
like, you know, this game is my idea, this is what I want people to do, was something that might have had its place in games, you know, a long time ago, and I think it still does and always will, especially in like the indie scene and stuff. But having, you know, even larger teams or more focused teams or even more industry research that's been done on these things is going to help the board game part not reach the level of video games and the amount of money and effort that are put into them just yet, but getting closer and closer in that direction. So
Yeah.
you know, maybe not necessarily a more complex product, but a more refined product that potentially could have longer development cycles. But again, this is all like it's hard to know, right? Like you mentioned, like it would have been hard 10 years ago to say that the board game industry will be here now. Just as I'm sure everybody's going to be a little bit wrong and a little bit right about where it's going, because you know, unexpected things are unexpected.
Yeah, and I think you're gonna see a lot more often, like any industry, it's like an ellipses, right? Where you have industry contracts and consolidates, and then from that you have few players, and then you have indie players spring up and then expands out, and then there's tons and tons of players, and then eventually it'll come back and it'll contract again. You have it, and it just keeps, this life cycle goes over and over again. And I think we're seeing that a little bit now in the industry. You're starting to see some consolidation, right? And at the same time, there's no shortage of small players jumping up. And the cool thing I think about globalization allows independence. Like I'm a company of one, right? Allows me to still get into this industry, right? And still be able to create a product. And that would have been unimaginable 20 years ago, right? One
Right.
person just couldn't have done this, couldn't have done small runs, couldn't have created kind of this boutique, hobby type of a game at the quality level we have today. I'm sure they could have done something, but at the quality level we're getting today, is really kind of this whole global marketplace has allowed for that. Speaking of
Yeah.
global marketplace, Can you, what brought you to Macedonia? Like, you used to be in the States, right? Now you're in Macedonia. There's got to be a story there.
It's I guess it's kind of a bittersweet thing. So I've been working for Final Frontier for, essentially since Merchants Cove and a little bit before that. And that was 2019, and 2020, was quite the year between the pandemic, and then my small town had a large wildfire, essentially. Like a power pole got knocked over during a windstorm, and a third of the houses in the entire town were completely just straight up gone, including my grandmother's house.
Oh my gosh.
And my parents' property sat up above that, and it was like when you'd visit there, you just look down and see where the house wasn't. So they had to go. And when they were going, my wife and I were like, well, we need to go because, there's nothing here for us anymore. And at that point, it's like, all right, well, we could go to Florida where everybody's moving, or we can try it in Macedonia because I already have a job here. I can negotiate, and we did negotiate something to make it doable for me to get over here. And they've given me, a ton of support with, paperwork and immigration and getting all this stuff figured out, to come here and actually be able to go into the office every day and work with my coworkers face to face and see them and test games and put them on the table. So that's been a really cool experience. And I don't really have any reservations about living abroad. I grew up in Germany. My parents were in the military, so I'm used to kind of being moved
Yeah.
around every couple of years. So it was another cool adventure for us, which was, the thing that pushed us out wasn't great, but we're happy where we are now. So everything
The new
ended up working out in
beginnings.
the end there. Yeah.
How's the gaming culture there?
So the gaming culture's it's on the rise, but it's definitely behind, I think, a lot of America and Western Europe. It just in that the price of games globally isn't something that is there's not a lot of margin to be had in board games. So across the world, you can't do regional pricing, and if you do, it's very, very minor. Games tend to hold their value, and one thing about Macedonia is that there's just not a high income level, and for most people, a board game is a like it's not something you'd even think to purchase, even if you knew about them and were into them. So it is getting better. There's more young people. There's actually a couple of board game cafes here in the city. But young people might have a game and it'll be like the game for their group and they'll play it a bunch, as opposed to like having a bunch of friends who are all collecting games at once. But that culture is rising too. Like it's very cool. We got to see some of the people that we play test with. They flew out to Essen because they wanted to grab up all the hot new titles. So, I think the board game fever, the desire for it is everywhere. It's just a matter of, are the games, are the is the culture and the pricing of board games accessible everywhere? It hasn't quite got there. But it's definitely, on the rise. And I'm surrounded by people who love and play board games. So also my perspective of that is probably a little bit skewed.
Yeah, for sure. And for Frontier, Final Frontier Games, given now like that you're in Europe, is most of your market weighted more towards the European market, or is still there a heavy market in the States, or is it kind of split half and half, or how do you guys kind of split yourself?
So most of our sales, as far as I understand, are from the States, and then we have
Okay.
some from Europe, and then we have a little bit from Australia and Asia. And we haven't much sold in Africa at this moment. And it's mostly because the kinds of games that we make are they tend to be deluxe, they tend to be large, and we haven't had as much success getting into distribution. So getting localizers, getting in with distributors who will push our games. So a lot of people who might even know games like Merchants Cove might not be able to find them as easily, readily available in every board game store or online everywhere. And that's just the other part of things is that it's with games like this, the model makes a lot more sense through Kickstarter because we're selling directly to the consumer. Not only can we offer them a price that we feel better about, but we're also getting a substantially larger amount of that money as opposed to going through distribution, like orders of magnitude. So not only do we need to get into distribution, then we need to make up for it with volume, which is still something that we're trying to do. And we've, always been trying to crack that nut. That's part of the reason that, publishers go to Essen is while the designers are there trying to make contacts with the publishers, with those stressful meetings, the publishers are turning right around and having the stressful meetings with the distribution companies to see if they can get, get their product in stores and in front of people. So.
I don't know if our listeners necessarily realize, but the, it's a substantial markup, right? When you, relative to what the consumer is paying, right? So if the consumer is paying, to keep the numbers clean, if you're paying $100 for a deluxe game at retail or on Kickstarter, for a distributor to sell that game, they're going to basically need 50 points. 40 to 50 points. So they're probably going to be buying that game for, say, $50 to $60. And if that store is going to take 50 to 40, 50 points, and then they buy from a distributor then needs anywhere from 15 to 25 points. So when you work back the math, you are selling that $100 game, which you'd be selling directly to a backer on Kickstarter. And even if you lose half of that in fees, you're still making maybe $50 a game. If you're trying to go the distribution route, you might only be selling that game for $25, right, to that distributor by the time all the
Yeah, or
markups go through the system,
maybe
if
even
you're lucky.
10.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it is razor thin, those margins. And I mean, everybody needs their piece. Obviously, everybody's got to try to make money along the way. But it makes it incredibly difficult for a publisher to, even break even some cases, right? If one thing goes wrong, that could blow your margins out of the water. So, more and more, you're seeing small players use Kickstarter as their predominant source of revenue for that game. Having that, using that to help them get their minimum runs, and then the extra copies they have, maybe they go through a distributor, maybe they sell direct through their own web store, maybe they sell on Amazon. But all these other cases or all these avenues are still a direct-to-consumer model, which allows that publisher to make that much more money. And I actually ran into this. I was talking to a colleague about Amazon. They're like, "Oh, I'll never support Amazon. They're killing the little guy." I go, "Amazon's propping up the little guy. What are you talking about? I've got distributors that won't even return my phone calls on some of my games, or I can sell directly to a consumer through my own Amazon store, and I control that sale. That money's going to me, right? So you're actually helping the little guy by supporting Amazon. So, you get this whole FLG, argument sometimes that, maybe it's hitting the small brick and mortars. But man, even selling to small brick and mortars is really tough. I've had brick and mortars I've tried to sell to here in Canada where they say, "No, I'm just going to buy it from my distributor in the States. My game from a distributor in the States instead of from me direct, because it's easier for them just to tick a box on a sheet." So it's a wacky model, the whole revenue model on this thing. We could spend an entire podcast on this.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
But really what I want to talk about is, let's talk about your game, The Sixth Realm, which is on Kickstarter right now. First and foremost, this is doing really, really well. I'm going to put it in Canadian dollars. It's the only way I can see it, but you're over $250,000, $277,000, over 2,000 backers, still 15 days to go, which is amazing. I got the screen kind of frozen on the your intro video that shows some of the feedback from some of the reviewers, and this one is Rado says best in class. You've got to be incredibly happy with all the feedback that you've received on this game, I gotta imagine.
Yeah, I mean, it's always a big unknown when you put a game out there and you hope people like it, and I think you always know that nobody's, especially in previews, it would be poor form to simply trash a game. But I feel like people can usually smell when there's some real enthusiasm and some authenticity to the excitement that people have, and being able to see that with this game because we really weren't sure. It's a little bit about outside of our wheelhouse of stuff that we've done before, so seeing the reception to that was really great from Rotto to Hunger Gamer. Carl from Purple Moose enjoyed it, so that's been really reassuring for us.
Yeah, it's robust. I was just scrolling over the components there in a second. Like, there's a lot of stuff here. Where did this game start? Like, where did the idea seed from? And then you're on there as I guess one of the designers. There's a few of you, I think, that are kind of tag teaming on this. How'd the idea kind of start with this one?
So the lineage of this game is that it's actually a game that Seth and Matthew had co-designed called Deities and Demigods that was pitched to us several years ago now. And we fell in love with the game, but more specifically with the action selection part of the game. The idea of these little bars and things that you can raise and track the points and the number scaling, you know, the 1, 3, 5, 8 creates an interesting decision. If I do one twice, it's worse than doing three once. And if I do five once, it's better than doing three and one once. So it's always better to move them up. But if you're moving them up, you're inherently foregoing opportunities to be doing things because you're moving them up instead of actually doing the things. So there was this immediately like really compelling trade-off. But the only problem with the game was it didn't fit the model that we were specifically sort of transitioning to here, where before almost everything that we've done has been sort of this middleweight Euro. You know, hovering around a three on BGG has been sort of our wheelhouse. And with this one, we wanted to see like, can we make something really big? And can we tap into maybe the Lacerda market, some of the heavier, you know, the most recent Tigris games from Garfield have gotten into this realm, you know, and can we create something that sort of blends our existing audience with this audience of sort of heavy gamers? And in addition to moving towards heavier Euros, we're also doing some more exploratory stuff. But this was the game that we felt like this has the bones in it. These action selection and a lot of the systems in the game are derived from ones that were in the original game. We just fell in love with that and wanted and felt like we could put a large game on top of it and operate a large game with that. So for the next year or so, I was, you know, knee deep in the trenches, essentially doing that. So it wasn't like a complete rebuilding of the game, but a lot of the systems had to be grown in certain ways, and a lot of the things had to be adapted. So there used to be like a coin mechanism, and that was the primary way of increasing your way of gaining these different movement on these different tracks to call in the different gods, which now are guilds. And that adapted into the merchants guild, which now has resources which do a similar thing but are on sort of like a tighter economy. And the dungeon, which you now, you know, go adventuring through with your little candle, that used to just be a track dedicated to the worship of Zeus. So, you know, it thematically had a shift a couple of times, but ultimately it's you can see the lineage from where the original design was to the much heavier version. And then of course once we got it to a much closer to where it is now, we had them jump back on board a little bit, give some feedback. You know, they actually fixed some of the outstanding problems that we had with a few of the little systems. And, you know, that's sort of the rough and dirty lineage of how we got from, you know, point A to point B. But it was a game made with a lot of, I guess, intentionality in a way that we haven't always done as a company. Sometimes it's been a lot more about like, you know, this is what the designer had, so we're going to take that and we're going to elevate, you know, the designer's original intention. And this was really the first time that we like wanted to do something kind of collaborative where we said like, we really love this part of this and so and some of the stuff that it's doing and some of the dynamics are at play here, so we want to crank those up to 11 and aim for, you know, a specific weight, a specific style and size of game. And it was really cool to approach game design from that angle for essentially the first time for me. So,
I mean, it certainly shows. And I was curious, like when you're saying, like you kind of throw it back to them, say, "Hey, can you see if you can fix this one thing, or kind of work on this a bit?" How, as a company, is that the kind of dynamic you guys have with some of the designers that bring games to you? Is it very much, "Hey, we're gonna now put our input into this, kind of set a path, and then we're gonna throw it back to you, and now you got to go and invest the time to basically get it kind of work back out and then bring it back to us."
Yeah, so that's been the other interesting part of my job besides just game development, and being the lead developer. I also end up doing a lot of the communication and the mediation between designers. Like we've got something brewing in the works with that we're not ready to announce, unfortunately, with Jay Cormier, who's got the Core of Discovery on Kickstarter right now. And I've been the main point of contact, and like we talk internally as a company, but then I am in charge of filtering those ideas down and communicating. And I really, really being somebody who's been on both sides of the equation, My biggest goal is to just be accommodating. So every case has been different. And sometimes it'll be we get a game, and essentially the designer's like, okay. And they step back, hands off, the game comes out. There's been other times where we get a game, and then the developer insists, or I'm sorry, the original designer insists on being like informed and up to date every single step of the way. Sometimes it's like you put the ball in our court for a while, and then we throw it to you, and it's in your court for a while, and we kind of do that until we, come to a consensus. But really, it's like direct communication when the project starts. I will tell the designer like whatever you are the most comfortable with. But essentially, the rule of thumb is up until the point that the game is handed off to us, our and my involvement is up to the designer. So a lot of the times it'll be like a counter proposal, like you pitch us something, we really like it, but for us to publish it, we think XYZ should change. And we'll say, we're not signing the game. If you change these things and we like it, we'll sign the game, essentially. You're not beholden to make the changes. That's just our feedback for us to really want to consider doing that. And sometimes we will get it, and then we'll even tell them, like, okay, now that we have it, here's what we want to change. We've signed the contract, and it's a similar process. Like, as much as you want to work on this before you finally sign it over to us, you can do that. If you want us to not be involved at all, that's great. If you want to have meetings with me every day and we'll kick ideas back and forth, we can also do that. But the moment you hand it over to us, then your involvement is up to you rather than our involvement. So if you just want to hand it off and go away, that's fine. If you want to hand it off and be, updated constantly or have like big check-ins, we can do that. It's, I realize that it might be useful to have sort of a standard, but games in the industry, it's just so weird. You never know when an idea is going to come from or from who or how much iteration it's going to need or work it's going to need, or even how you might feel about an idea, whether you feel protective of the idea and you really want to be, involved in every step, or if you feel confident in the idea in a different way where you believe it's resilient and it could create a good game in any number of ways, then you feel okay, being a little more hands off. So, yeah, it's a, unfortunately, it's a complicated answer.
Well, there's got to be balance in there as well, is because I'm thinking like from the publisher standpoint, often I'll talk to people about what that process looks like when you sell, but or sign, but I usually say like once you sign, it's really up to the publisher's discretion, right? Like it is their call, because they're the ones that are now taking all the risks going forward, and you got to be okay with that, right? And you might have some designers that are not okay with that. I know one that's at a local kind of prototyping event that I see the same designer with the same game. I've seen him there 5 years in a row, and I've had discussions with them. I'm saying this is a really cool looking game. Have you thought about having somebody publish it, and or pitching it to publishers? And his response is, "Well, it's kind of my baby. Like I don't know if I could see it in someone else's hands because I'd really want to be involved in every step along the way." That can be very challenging for a publisher where they know, especially you as a developer, saying, "Hey, I know I got to get it to here in order for this to kind of fit our model and be, successful within our model." And if I'm having to drag that designer from the moment of signing all the way to kind of the finish line, that's going to be an excruciating process as well. How
Right.
do you handle that with the des is it a candid conversation you have with the designer up front, or how do you kind of navigate that? Because I got to imagine that would be challenging, right?
The sort of sidestep answer to that is kind of funny because my answer is that we sort of sidestep that. And the way that we do that is with some pre-screening. And I don't know if this is the same for all publishers, and I don't know if I'm saying too much here. But a lot of the times, some of the initial sell sheets, some of the initial like responses back from publishers, it is honest and truthful, yes, but also they're trying to gauge your reaction and see just how easy to work with you're going to be. And if we can see that somebody's not going to be easy to work with, that's going to inform our decision on whether or not we're gonna try and work with them. So we'll be pitched a game, we'll think it's, okay, let's have a prototype, we'll play the prototype. And we'll think like, okay, if we were to publish this, what would we do? And we'll often just give them that feedback. And seeing how they respond to it is key. And thankfully, most of the people that we've worked with and who pitch to us are very receptive and open to the feedback. But we've had a few people who are a little more like, okay, I don't agree. Thanks for your time. At that point, that's okay with me.
Yeah, you did
People
each
sort
other
of
a favor,
self-select at
really,
that point.
right?
Yes. Yeah, so that's kind of how we navigate the difficult designer thing, is that we try to make sure that these are people that we want to work with
Yeah.
going forward. And we'll often work with people multiple times. We've worked with, Carl multiple times. We did Merchant's Cove, and then we did Bardwood Grove. And he's pitched us more games that we've almost signed and that have now been signed to other places that we give feedback on. So fostering a good relationship with publishers is not hard. Like, all it takes is just like being polite, basically.
Yeah, and
And
being
that
open
can
and
get you a
receptive to
lot of
feedback as
places.
well, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, sort of how I got into these things, just by offering to help out with things, with Final Frontier, and sort of making sure that they knew who I was. So when it came time that I had a game idea or they needed my help, I was the guy that they knew. Because most of the times, companies aren't going to put out an open call for things. And a lot of the games that you see signed, they don't go through the whole sell sheet, that whole rigmarole. It's just they'll reach out and say, "Hey, are you working on anything? I know you make these kinds of games. We're looking for that kind of game. Do you have anything in the works, or do you want to make anything for us?" And that's a lot easier to navigate with a known quantity of designer and product than it is with just somebody from the outside that's a little bit more of a wild card.
Yeah, it's
But
an
being
established
polite.
shorthand you start gaining with people you're working with, right? Where you have that efficiency that kind of comes along with that, which I think is so important. And relationships, I think, are everything in this industry, right? And I always encourage people, if you meet a publisher, like there's one thing is pitching your game, but also offer, is there anything I can do to help? Or is there anything I can do? How can I get involved with your company? Is there play testing you guys are doing? I'd love just to kind of get to know some of the people on your team. Maybe something comes out of that, maybe it doesn't, but
The quickest way to a publisher's heart would be to offer to play test. If you can, I mean, especially if you can like organize and stuff, like you will be the golden child in their eyes. And if you want to pitch them a game, I guarantee you they will listen. And that's sort of the other route that's not often talked about, because it's not as clear to see the feedback and see where you're going. Like doing the sell sheet thing, like you can see the progress being metered out. Whereas this is a little more ephemeral, a little more social, but I think ultimately is a more common case.
no, I totally agree. So with the sixth realm, for those who want to check this game out, I'm going to put a link in the show notes. I encourage people to check this. It is like a feast on the eyeballs. That's all I can say when you're looking on this Kickstarter page. There's so much in this game. Like, I don't even think you could explain it in a 30-minute session. Like, there's so much. I think anybody that likes Euros are just going to sink their teeth into this baby. Like, it is cool. And I want to congratulate your team on this, because clearly you guys have put a lot of time and thought into just exactly how to present this, and it shows in not just the game, but the way even you lay out your Kickstarter page and how you've approached the different previewers and so forth to kind of talk about it. Like, it really is the full package, and there's a reason why your team is seeing the success that they're seeing. So I want to congratulate you on that. Again, for people who want to check out The Sixth Realm, please go in the show notes, check there. Of course, on the Board Game Binge Podcast Facebook group, join us there as well. We'll have a replay of this video and a link. Drake, I want to wish you all the best in this coming year on this game, and all the best of success.
Yeah, thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
All right, my friend, you take care. Cheers. This has been an episode of the Board Game Binge Podcast, hosted by James Staley, produced by James Staley and Mike Bruner, with original music by Nick Smith. If you would like to watch these interviews live, simply subscribe to our YouTube channel, Board Game Binge, and you'll get access to live interviews, giveaways, and interesting board game content from across the industry. I can't wait for you to join us. See you next time.